once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
A good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting, that might be promissory, sort of fun, still kind of an interesting, well, I'm really flailing here. This is going to be the personal wealth coach. Oh, that's 100% truthful. We're going to do our best to be exciting and interesting, but if you've ever listened to us before, you know that we're very trying. How hard we're trying is irrelevant. We are very trying. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and on the air with, this is Jake McClure, and on the air with me I have...
Jeff McClure.
We don't have a visual cue for me to read his lips and time my coordination of our names. So rather than subject you to us being out of sync, out of bath, I don't know. We'll just say it separately. This is Veterans Day.
Yes, it is.
And on the air with me, I have a veteran. I would like to take this moment to thank you.
I represent that.
For putting yourself in harm's way for a long time so that I could live the fat, lazy life that I do. And anybody that knows me knows how true that is.
Or not.
Or well, the fat part. But the lazy, maybe. You know, I'm at least not so lazy, but like relaxed life. The life free of missiles coming from the sky and people marching across my yard. Things like that. I appreciate it. More than I can say, really. I'm being kind of joking about it. But having seen what you put yourself through, your body and mind, I appreciate you quite a lot. Thank you for your service. And thank all of you veterans that are listening as well. You have created the ability for us to be ambivalent about military stuff by being so good at military stuff. We wouldn't have the ability to wish for peace and tranquility and to put flowers into rifle barrels if we didn't have really big rifle barrels pointing back the other way. And I appreciate it very much. Thank you all. Now, on to disclosures. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm, and that's not a coincidence, because the two guys speaking on the air with you are the two principals at that firm. This radio program predates the firm by quite a bit. That's where the firm's name came from. Elder Baldy Jeff here came up with that in a brainstorm session, and it stuck. So the Personal Wealth Coach is an SEC-registered investment advisory, and it's also this program. Two different things, though. We can't give fiduciary investment advice on the air because privacy, because we don't know you all. Well, maybe we do. Maybe there's nobody listening, and we know no one. but anyway you look at it, it's not appropriate to give personalized investment advice in a public setting. It also is strange in that we can't give investment advice because we don't know you all, so we got to give education. Even though we're signed up to be fiduciaries, our role here is as teachers, which is a different sort of fiduciary role of trying to impart knowledge rather than tell you what to do specifically. Just because the firm's registered with the SEC does not mean that the SEC has anointed us or has given us some special place to sit on the table with Odin in Valhalla or any other abstract religious references or regulatory references for that matter. They're just the regulatory organization. And it's kind of like when you show your Texas driver's license or New York driver's license, it doesn't mean that the state of Texas or New York has somehow said that you are free from all possible wrongdoing. Nope, that's just who gave the license. So slightly different, but you get the analogy. Let's see here. What else do we? Oh, we don't pay for this radio program. I know that's weird. It's Saturday morning and there's paid programming all over Saturday morning. Our program predates that craze back when AM radio actually was profitable without having canned audiences clapping and laughing and such. Maybe they did that too. How Orwellian of us. Thinking back to that, there was canned laughter, wasn't there? So no, we're not paying for this program. We do buy advertisements on the station, but we're actually talking to them because they haven't updated our prices in way, way long. So we may wind up paying more for our advertisements in the future. We'll see. This is a normal negotiation, and it kind of lets you know that we're paying for our advertisement time. We're not paying for this program. And we haven't for 26 years. It's been free to them, free to us. 2 hours plus prep time once a week for 26 years. If you do the math on that, it's a lot. And I'm not going to attempt it because I'll do the math to see how much time I would waste to figure out how much time I wasted. That seems like a waste of time to me. You have a disclosure to give.
Well, I do, in fact. The information we present on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no claim or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
I like how you switched that up this week.
I did. I changed it a little.
Claim for guarantee, which is kind of close, but different, has good meaning. It's very nice. Too bad the thesaurus went extinct.
Well, I've still got several here.
I think those are paleontological finds that you have dusted out of your...
Is a group of them called a thesauri?
It might be.
Or a thesaurae.
Did you find it in like a matrix of other ancient things made of paper from the time before the internet?
I have entire shelves of things made of paper here.
See, that's called the
matrix. And leather, too.
That's called in paleontology terms, that's called a matrix. So when you find a fossil in matrix, that's what you're, so that whatever that shelf of matrix that you have there, that you pulled out your thesauri.
Does that mean I'm going to be able to jump up in the air and grab bullets and dodge them and things like that?
Yeah, because you were in the matrix, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, clear.
Yeah, and we can zoom around you in a circle while you slowly do things. It's amazing. It's supposed to imply that you're going fast. That's why it's so slow. Just like the market.
Makes perfectly good sense because, well, I know I'm going very fast.
Because of rotation around?
No.
Where are you going fast?
Because 2023 just started the other day.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And we're closing in on the end of it. It's mid-November. And I'm thinking it maybe ought to be February or March.
Well,
which means time is definitely speeding up.
I'll complete that for you. Okay. 2023 just started the other day and is just going to end the other day.
Okay.
Yeah. So I guess
you know the story about how people perceive time.
I used to know it, but I forgot. But
if you're 5 years old, 1 year is 20% of your life.
Ah, I see where you're going with that.
I remember one of my earlier memories is of a time when a summer, when I got out of school, I was in an early elementary school age, mm-hmm. the summer lasted forever. Yeah. It just seemed to go on and on and on and on. And now, well, I don't know, in Texas, with it this hot, it seems to drag on a bit too.
Right. Well, there's some neuroscience behind that as well. And if you would like your time to last longer, there is real evidence on what you can do. It's not being facetious. Learn something new, something you have not done before. Mm-hmm. As a child at age 5, everything is new. Do you remember? I mean, this is a great example of this. You're driving to a place for the first time. You're checking the directions. You're making sure you don't miss any exits. It seems like it takes as long as it takes to get there. I know that seems kind of weird. After you've already done it 3 times, how long does it take to drive there? It's like, I don't even remember taking the exits. It's just, it happened because it's not new anymore.
In correlation with that, I also noticed that it takes me a lot longer to get someplace I haven't been before than it does to get home. I get home at about half the time, time.
I mean, see, that's it, is that you are actually found a way to break physics. You are actually warping, no, just your perception. It's improbable, infinitely.
I want to talk about that today.
We just lost our connection to K-Tim. I am going to call back in. And we're back. We really are back with the personal wealth coach. That was a rude interruption. If you guys didn't want to talk to us, you didn't have to just hang up. I mean, I realize you don't feel very powerful when it comes to the radio. You can change the channel, but somehow you hung up on us. I really appreciate that effort. But we are not to be dissuaded. We will come back. We will speak about economics. This is the personal wealth coach, and Elder Baldy Jeff, but is about to tell us what happened in the market this week.
All right. Well, the market did its usual weekly thing of behaving in the short term irrationally, and I presume in the long term rationally. Last week through Wednesday, November 8th, the S&P 500 stock index, which I want to talk about more about in a little bit, did 8 consecutive days of rises, which is, if it had gone one more, it would have broke, it would have had the longest series of consecutive up days since 2004. But on Thursday, it lost its nerve. And why did it lose its nerve?
Well, can I break in a second?
Sure.
How many days in a row is the record since 2004?
9
days of up in a row. So that's just just more than almost 2 weeks. Okay, almost 2 full weeks. We haven't had that happen in consecutive days more than...
In almost 10 years.
We think of it 2004?
Yeah, that's
19,
20 years, almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years. Yes, so you're showing your age a little by saying, oh, it's only 10 years ago. But yeah,
I know time flies when you're having fun.
Right. And if you're Kermit, time's fun when you're having flies.
Yeah, time's fun when you're having flies. I got that.
Yeah. Okay. Back to you, sir.
Well, and so on what happened on is Wednesday, the Federal Reserve had its meeting, and then there was a news conference in the afternoon, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve came out and said, we did nothing. And we did it with a great deal of enthusiasm. And
that's not really what he said. He really said, we're going to continue doing what we're doing without changing it.
Right. Well, we did nothing.
Essentially the same thing. Right. Go ahead.
He refers to it as hitting pause. Well, if you're a dog, that's bad. But for the rest of us, pause means you stopped everything. And but then he went on to say, but we're certainly open to raising rates in the future if inflation doesn't continue to abate. And so the market, as it opened on Wednesday, headed south, because that's really bad because the Fed might raise rates. Like, they didn't know that.
Right.
I mean, it was such a surprise. He's only been saying that now forever.
Right. And he just didn't raise rates.
Right.
And they're like, he didn't raise rates. And he says he might not. But that he said might. You know, okay. So go ahead.
So then outcomes, that was Federal Reserve says the economy, by the way, in the midst of that, he said the economy is booming along and maybe going a little too fast, but we're going to take some time and wait and see what these higher rates are doing. And we noticed that the long-term bonds rates are going up pretty much on their own, not entirely. The Fed is kind of nursing them along. And that's going to slow the economy too. So we're going to wait and see for a while. And we think we'll just wait and see, but we might have to raise rates again in the future. So the market went down because they might have to raise rates in the future. Then the next day, the market fell on Thursday. And then on Friday, out comes the news that consumer confidence is unusually low. You get that? Consumer confidence is unusually low because consumers expect to have high inflation over the next several years. They expect inflation to go up despite the fact that inflation has very clearly been declining all year. Consumers, apparently, the ones who answered the phone at least, apparently just now woke up to the fact that we've had a lot of inflation. And so the consumer confidence drops to a 12-year low.
Well, I mean, we talked about this a little bit last week, and we've got more conversation about it this week, about perceived confidence and having to change that survey's wording because things are different after a pandemic in your confidence.
And of course, you know, the market then shot up because that was bad news for the economy. And it caused economists all over to say, well, maybe we will have a recession, which caused the market to shoot up. We wrote in the newsletter, like a SpaceX rocket ship. It went up, it made up all the losses that it had and wound up at the end of the week, the S&P 500 up 1.13%, which doesn't sound like very much unless you multiply it times 52, because there's 52 weeks in the year, and it's up 1.13% for 1 week. And then suddenly it sounds like a lot. It's
right.
Not like the 5% it went up week before last. The key though, and it closed at 4415.24. And I think there's a key here. When the market dropped to a certain point, now the pundits are giving the consumer confidence rating credit for kicking the market back up. I don't think so. Reason I say that is if you look at how consumers behave by where they're spending their money and how they're spending their money on, and then you read the consumer confidence surveys, they're either all schizophrenics or there's something out of whack, because consumer confidence is often reported as low, and then during the month it's reported as low, you look back and realize that consumers went out and put money on revolving credit to buy durable goods that are going to take several years to pay off at a record high.
Right.
So they think the economy is sliding downhill and I'm probably going to lose my job, so I'm going to go out and obligate myself to spend money over the next several years. No, there's something wrong there. I think personally that the surveys, and for that matter, the polls, are not anywhere near as reliable as they once were. And I think it has a lot to do with cell phones.
Well,
anyway.
It has to do. And we can talk about that in a minute, too. But
yeah,
cell phones and the kind of confidence that we have now, this happens anytime you have a massive shift in attitude in a country. You can see it very clearly in China right now. You can see it very clearly in the United States right now. How we feel about things has changed. This happens throughout history. It's usually takes place over a 10-year period instead of in a 2-year period. You have 30 years of essentially the same feeling about things being modulated by small events. Then something like a wall comes down somewhere and your confidence changes because one of the major factors to how you felt is no longer there. The same thing happened during the pandemic, and it happened in a lot of different ways in a lot of different places, but it's measurable. And we're still asking the same questions we asked before there was a pandemic, which means we got to change the questions that we're asking. The way we feel about things, I don't know about you, but I certainly feel different than I did 5 years ago about what's going on in the world. And that's speaking from somebody who just happens to have COVID at the moment. So yesterday and the day before were rather bad. Today, not so much. So hopefully that's good and continues on an upward trajectory. But you were right in the middle of the market, and I had to throw in stuff about moods and behavior. And
throwing in is like okay. Throwing up is awkward.
Yes. It's all about prepositions.
So the S&P, let's talk about the S&P 500 for just a minute. It closed above the 4,400 level, which is psychologically important. And for the people who read market tea leaves, otherwise known as technicians, that's a critical level and suggests that we're headed for higher levels in the future. Now, are those assumptions right? I don't know. But it's now up 15% year to date, the S&P 500. It's up over 23% from October 22. It's up over 97% since March of 2020 and 23% from this time last year. I kind of get the feeling that that equates to a bull market, but I probably would be in a minority with that. Anyway,
but that probably means you're right when it comes to the market when you're in a minority. Almost always means you're right, unless you're in a weird minority, which is wrong. And you don't know about that until later. So you're either right or you're wrong until you're proven by history. So what you're saying
is if you graft all the outliers, they'd make a bell curve of their own.
Yeah. And okay. And there's a lot of, especially when you're talking about politics, a lot of the outliers are grafting. So
yeah, that's true. Anyway. We watch another index, and I'm going to explain in just a second why we watch this. It's called CRSP U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index. For the week, it fell 1.38% to 2247.24 and is down nearly 4% this year. Now, there's several reasons we watch that. One, we like that asset class. But there's another one. Fortunately, because it's really hard to get this data, there was an article in The Economist that said, don't watch the S&P 500. Watch the S&P 493. There is no index S&P 493, although I wish there was so I could watch it. If you take the seven largest companies out of the S&P 500, now they equate to roughly 25 or 30% of the total value of the 500 stock index.
503. There's 503.
503 stock index. And you pulled seven out. I guess so that would change the S&P 500 to -7 +3.
We're not calling it S&P 503 right now. So we're still going to round it. And it's a very loose rounding. But
that would make it the 499 then. Okay.
Right. Okay.
Anyway, the point I wanted to make is if those seven companies were not in the S&P 500, the S&P 500, as of the date of this article being published, which was last week, and actually they had a date before that, but for the data, but they didn't say what it was. The S&P 500's performance would be very, very similar to the U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index if you took just seven stocks, the seven largest stocks out of it. And you would recognize the names of all of them. It's basically all the high-tech stocks, NVIDIA and Apple and Microsoft and Meta. You can guess at the other ones. And if you took those stocks out of the S&P 500, the S&P 500 would be flat to down this year. And unless you're invested in those seven stocks and you've got a stock portfolio, odds are it's not up, but you shouldn't feel bad because not only do those seven stocks have they risen the most over the last couple of years. When the market does fall, they fall the most.
Or have fallen and the most.
They have fallen the most and probably will in the future. And we've certainly seen this happen before. But it's an important thing to recognize that the indices don't necessarily reveal what's going on in the main part of the market unless you are a very aggressive, large cap growth stock investor. If you're a very aggressive, large cap growth stock investor.
It's funny because it's poop.
And you're willing to recognize. Let me explain why. Why don't we just jump on those? Because, I mean, obviously they go up. It's because we have some memory. Had you been invested in the S&P 500 stock index, which also during that time period had very few stocks that were driving the index up in late 1999 and into 2000. Had you been invested just in the S&P 500, and let's just say, and matter of fact, I looked this up, the oldest S&P 500 index fund, and you threw a lump sum in at the end of 2000, it would have been 13 years, if we take inflation into account, before you broke even. It would have been 10 years before you broke even. Between 7 to 10 years, you would have broken even for a few minutes, not counting inflation. So, yeah, these guys go up like a SpaceX rocket ship, but they tend to come down like the second stage, not the first stage.
Just as a side note, the first stage is recovered. The second one, they recover if they can after it falls in the ocean a long ways away and rather quickly.
I got to watch one. I got to watch a second stage decelerating over West Texas as it was getting ready to plunge into the Atlantic Ocean, having made one loop around the earth already. And it was a fireball. It was pretty interesting. Anyway, so that's what's happened in the stock market. The market, the S&P 500 is up. The mainstream market is at a break even for the year, but it's up from where it was in October of last year. So it's still up. So now let's go back to U.S. Treasury 10-year note as the week progressed along and the Fed did not raise interest rates and consumer confidence came in with a negative. The 10-year note finished the week with a 4.61% yield. It pulled back from its brush 2 weeks ago with 5%. So that's a pretty good drop. It still leaves the Treasury yield curve very, very inverted, meaning that short-term rates are much higher than long-term rates. The 90-day T-bill at the end of the week, this week, was yielding 5.53%, which I still found astonishing. Having been in this business now for over 40 years, I think 41 years I've been in this business now, a T-bill at 5% is pretty impressive. T-bill at 5.53% is astonishing. West Texas crude oil prices also went down, and even as the yields on the Treasury 10-year note went down, dropped to $77.34. Again, that's kind of good. And by the way, there's a very good article. I'll transition to you in just a second, but I wanted to end this with a little comment. There's a good article out there. I'll remember in a minute which news media source it came from. Here it is. And let me give due credit. Bloomberg had a very good article that points out that the perceptions of future inflation are perfectly inverted when compared with consumer confidence ratings. In other words, when they go out and look for consumer confidence, one of the questions they ask is, how confident are you about your job in the future? How confident are you the economy will run well into the future. And they also ask, what do you expect inflation to be? And apparently a majority of the respondents said they expect inflation to take off and rise tremendously into the near future, which is, of course, the reverse of what we've been seeing in month to month. And the reason is that the newspapers and everything else do not report month to month inflation. You have to dig down into the report, in the details of the government reports to see them. And we report them in our newsletter, and we talk about the fact that inflation has been between 1.2 and 2.4% month to month now for about 6 months. And that is where pretty much the Fed wants it to be, which is probably why they didn't raise rates this time. But the consumer confidence is going the other way. And the reason is that consumers believe for some reason that inflation will rise tremendously in the next 6 months, which isn't true, but that's all right. And that was the markets.
All right. Well, you mentioned something just quick in passing. Did you mention West Texas Intermediate?
I did.
It was interesting to note what's happened with
it's
oil.
It's falling. Yeah.
This last month I came back from Galveston and I talked about the new oil rigs in the Gulf that are moving up production. We're seeing kind of getting close to our top production mark in the United States for what we've ever produced. And right in the middle of that, something kind of slipped under the radar. Something happened with Venezuela last month, right in the middle of the month, but kind of approaching the end of the month. And that is that a lot of the sanctions on their oil exports were released. I know this seems like a strange little mention, but they used to produce at their peak about 5 million barrels a day. They've been hovering around 300,000 to 500,000 for the past about 7 years. Most of that is traded to China because there's so many sanctions on Venezuela. It's essentially struggling at being a failed state. And well, how did the sanctions get lifted? Well, a whole bunch of people from Europe and the United States met in Barbados with a bunch of people from Venezuela, and they said, hey, you guys have elections that outside parties can monitor next year for the president, and we'll let you start exporting. So Qatar has started is reopening a refinery in the Caribbean. Notice not in Venezuela. Venezuela has a habit of seizing property of oil explorers and keeping it for themselves and being very popular with its own people for doing so. So Qatar's not going, even though they kind of mediated this new deal, they're not going to put a bunch of money into Venezuela where they can yank it back. So they're opening a refinery in the Caribbean, and it's an interesting little piece of data in that part of the reason why Venezuela's oil exports dropped and its oil production dropped was they didn't know how to run the equipment that was purchased and run by large oil companies. So when they seized it from the oil companies, a lot of people left that were running it for some reason. Their employers weren't paying them anymore. And so they did fine for a while, but then production started falling, and it fell fast when it started falling. So why am I bringing this up? Because crude oil is trading at right about $77 a barrel now in West Texas Intermediate. At the same time, we're about to hit winter, and Europe is looking around going, what are we going to do? Only not so much this year, because we're exporting so much more liquid natural gas to Europe from the United States. They have an abundance. They're not going to probably need to dip into their reserves this winter, even though Russia's not sending them any. So a lot of the issues with Russia and oil are being pulled out of the system because Russia is such a monster. And right at the same time that Venezuela's sanctions are lifted, the UK hit Russian gold and oil sectors with new sanctions. So who is buying Russia's oil now, just as a side note? India and China, mostly China. So basically, China's reaching around trying to find cheap oil. It can't get it from Venezuela anymore because Venezuela is now able to sell it at normal prices to the rest of the world. China was getting it cheap because everybody else was sanctioning Venezuela. They're getting it cheap from Russia because Russian oil is sanctioned, and they're saying, hey, nobody else is going to buy it. We'll buy it. We're the only purchaser, so we'll pay you less than what other people would have. So that's going on. We're tightening more on the oil on Russia. At the same time that this is happening, Russia's looking around and basically saying China is its lifeline. Without China right now, the Ukraine war would not be functional because Russia still is selling oil. It's just selling the vast majority of it to China. Without that oil, it wouldn't have the income to continue the war. Well, it's a lot less income than it was prior to the war. For the first years, well, I guess about 8 months of the war, they stayed pretty equilibrium on the oil sales because the rest of the world had to get untied from them. Well, now China's out there doing this, and then something interesting happened on Thursday, and it sounds like I'm about to change the subject. Bear with me. I'll come back. On Thursday, the U.S. Treasury did a big auction. They do this regularly. This is how they sell bonds and notes and bills. When we talk about the U.S. Treasuries that people are buying, their initial release is at an auction. Now, it's not with an auctioneer and a room full of people with paddles. Used to be. It's not that way anymore. In fact, the way it works is that they have one trading institution, and there's some cool stories around that, that is available to do the auction for the treasury. If you've ever been to a government auction, you realize that they're not necessarily going to get the best prices for things when they do it themselves. Why that is, I'm not really sure. But when the county auctions a house, when the bankruptcy court auctions stuff, usually you get really cheap prices for things that you would have to pay a lot more elsewhere. The government recognized that way, way, way back at the time of Hamilton and before, and said, we're not going to do our own auctions. We're going to hire an expert at this to do it for us. In this case, they're using the Bank of New York Mellon. It's not always been the bank that they use. If you want to look into 9/11 and the Treasury scare after 9/11, it's worth it. The firm that they used prior was utterly destroyed on 9/11. So the U.S. government had to scramble to find someone with the appropriate security and secrecy to sell the treasuries at auction. Well, they settled on Bank of New York Mellon. Bank of New York Mellon is a good bank. I'm not going to give them any kind of kudos or lack of kudos or anything else. They're a good bank. Part of it was founded by Alexander Hamilton, the other by Mellon. These are both really conservative bank concepts. If you want to think about banks as being conservative and not taking risk, this is a good example. There are other banks in that category. This is an old one and a big one. So it seems reasonable for them to be the ones in charge. Now, the requirements to be the sole auctioneer of U.S. treasuries from the government are rather high. Security is off the wall high, off the charts, up the wall, through the roof. I'm going to mix as many metaphors as possible. I have a new blender. So they're required to be extra secure because this is not a situation that needs to get messed up. So Thursday, we have this big auction. The way this works is there are a series of other big banks who are all signed up with the government to be sponsors, if you will, of the auction. So they have to show up and they bring clients. Their clients will buy at the auction. So it's kind of like a representative democracy. A bunch of people come together and say, I'm going to put my orders through this company, and this company is going to put its order in the auction against the Bank of New York Mellon's auctioneer. Okay. Well, China has one bank that it uses for all of its purchases. China has a lot of banks back in China. So this is a fascinating little piece of data. On Thursday, there was a weird thing that happened at auction. A lot of orders that were expected just didn't occur. People that normally bid were silent, and they had been telling, this is a kind of auction where they tell the auctioneer in advance, yeah, we're going to buy a bunch of stuff this week or this month or on Thursday, depending on how many auctions they go to. And the auctioneer goes, okay, we'll be expecting that just to keep it orderly. We're not going to have like a scrum of chaos as people are bidding all at the same time. They're going to slowly approach that. They slowly approached it, and then the orders didn't show up. And these are from Chinese banks. And they said, well, what's going on here? Well, the sponsors of the auction, the big, big banks that come to the auction, have a requirement. The government has all kinds of requirements on this stuff. Hey, if we come to auction and you tell us, a bunch of you tell us you're going to make orders, and then those orders don't show up, the sponsor banks have to buy the rest, which seems a little bit weird, but it's the government talking here, and it's not like Louis XIV, who would just go and have whole noble families killed to take their fortune for the crown to pay. You don't need to issue bonds if you can just take somebody's money. Well, in this case, they said, in order to be orderly, we need you to step in if the bids aren't there that you say are going to be there. So about 25% of that auction was purchased by the sponsors. This caused a pretty drastic 5-minute change in the yield on the 30-year treasury. It went from 4.7 to, it went up from 4.6 to about 4.8. That doesn't seem like a lot when we look back over the last year and a half or so of increased rates. But in a 5-minute period, that's nuts. It didn't even bring us back to where we were November 7th, but it happened very fast. And anybody watching the charts saw the spike and they said, what's going on? There's not enough people to buy the debt. So the rumors started in the background. You didn't see a lot of the of headlines about this. They were just, it was one of the things I was planning on talking about, to just bring this stuff out and talk about how underlying, how we have checks and balances in place to prevent horrible catastrophes from occurring. Well, then the news started coming out. The one bank that I was talking about that deals for China, and that's really what they're doing. They're buying and selling for, they're dealing for the Chinese stuff, is Industrial and Commerce Bank of China, ICBC. And they're a huge chunk of this. They had $9 billion that they were supposed to buy, which is a big chunk of the auction. They had orders in place and they'd already issued them to BNY Mellon. They said, here's the money. Here's our orders and we'll give you the money as soon as you get the order done. So BNY Mellon said, hey, you said you were going to do this. You didn't do it at the auction, but you ordered these. You need to pay for them. So the parent bank, which is the Chinese government of ICBC, wired $9 billion to the Bank of New York Mellon. Why? What happened? It was a ransomware attack. Now, how is this all connected back to the oil and Russia and all that silliness that I said, bear with me? A ransomware attack occurred, and on that ransomware, who did it? Who set this up? It's a place called Lockbit. I don't recommend Googling it. If you follow the links, you might get some ransomware yourself. It is a platform, if you will, for hackers to buy software or to post software specifically for the purpose of encrypting someone else's information with a password only you own, so that if they want that information, they have to pay you money. And that's what happened to ICBC. Lockbit software was used as in a ransomware attack against the single firm allowed to trade in U.S. treasuries from China. Now, China is a big buyer of treasuries. They own about $800 billion of U.S. treasuries. It used to be about $1.4 trillion back in 2018. They've been having some issues of their own and have been slowly not buying or selling. They have been selling some, but not buying as much. Japan is now the number one holder and has been since about 2019 of U.S. treasuries external to the country. By far, the number one owner of U.S. debt are United States citizens. Okay, so China's trying to buy and it can't. What is it trying to buy? It is the only firm allowed to buy U.S. treasuries for China, period. It's just not possible to do it otherwise. And in the process of doing this, who's hacked them? Where is Lockbit? This is where the tieback comes from. Hopefully, I didn't create the level of suspense that I wanted to, but it's coming back. Lockbit is based in Russia. Just let that sink in for a second. There's a massive ransomware attack on a Chinese bank that is the only one allowed to do trade with the United States from a Russian designed set of software, and most often it's a Russian backed hacker. They have a little, those of you that have listened for a while know that I kind of look into the crypto back news, like by crypto encryption, not the currency side, to figure out what's going on in the big wide world. And it's still a bit of the Wild West, but there are some firms that are truly gifted with security. And mostly that's just making it very difficult for anybody to be able to log into a system. So ICBC was shut out of the network from Bank of New York Mellon before they announced the ransomware attack. So think about that for a second. Bank of New York Mellon noticed weird transactions and odd orders or delays in orders occurring from ICBC and shut them out of the network. Then the ransomware attack is confirmed. And Bank of New York Mellon says, we're not going to allow you back into the network until you've had a third-party audit from one of these three firms to make sure your encryption and levels of security are all in place, because we're not going to have this market crash. Our job is to keep an orderly market. And we're not going to have it crash from an external event that has nothing to do with the market. So This is a tale, two tales, one of utter failure and a weird political friendship between Russia and China, and two of a system that was designed in advance for this kind of failure. We often talk about failures in the aftermath of a massive catastrophe in finance where everything collapsed and it was horrible and nobody knew this was coming. We don't usually talk about the planes that land safely. And this is one where an engine fire started. Not only was it handled safely, it was handled exemplarily well. The landing of that aircraft is being reported, at least by me. You may not hear much about this at all elsewhere, but there's some intricacies on the political scene, on the oil trade, and on the treasuries trade, and on Russia's move against China. Because China's going to see this as Russia, period. There's no doubt about that. The hacking conglomerations in Russia only exist because Putin allows it, because a lot of them work for him as well. Now they're attacking China, and China's taking notice. $9 billion had to come out of government funds to bail out a bank that was hacked by their purported ally, who, without China, would be in a much larger world of hurt. So this is kind of a big story. It's just all underneath the surface, and you only probably saw little blips of that on the surface of something weird just happened. Well, there you go. That was my long-winded, it's a big subject, and it covers oil and banks, but it mostly covers China and Russia and the intricacies of what's happening there. And it's visible on the economic side that there is a lot less camaraderie between Russia and China than would be expected here, or it will lead to less, because maybe Russia didn't know this was going to happen, but they're still the ones holding the bag at the end of the heist, going, or some words in Russia to that effect.
One of the things I learned over the years, I used to work in military intelligence as a strategic and tactical intelligence officer.
I've got an obligatory, what an oxymoron. Now, back to you.
Well, actually, and the consensus among the intelligence analysts in the United States was that if the Russian army ever attacked,
this is back during Cold War, the Soviet army back then.
Yes. Right. Well, it's basically the same army that we have today. It's organized exactly the same way and has some of the same equipment, which should tell you something weird about the fact that a third of a century after the fall of the Soviet Union or more, they're still using exactly the same tactics and exactly the same strategy and, in many cases, exactly the same equipment.
You want to do a quick hour wrap up, and we'll have a lot more little pieces of stuff next hour.
Well, generally speaking, the market was up for the week, various amounts and various indices. It's moving along very nicely. The economy is humming along nicely. The rest of the situation is that inflation continues to be down. The Federal Reserve did not raise interest rates, but they said they might raise interest rates. The only negative for the week really was the consumer confidence level was reported lower than usual, but these are the same people who just went out and bought a whole bunch of long-term stuff on borrowed money. So I really don't believe that they think the economy is about to tank.
No.
So that's the quick wrap up on my side of it. And we're about out of time.
Yep. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give fiduciary customized investment advice and portfolio management that we can't do on the air, off the air. We do this for people of relatively high net worth. If you would like to call us locally, we have voicemail, but during the week, it's real live people, no phone trees. You can reach us locally at
254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Doesn't mean the same as it used to back when everybody had a phone on the wall, but you know, in your pocket. It's not any different to do local or long distance. Amazing. And if you're a millennial and younger listening, you're like, oh, what an old fogey. All right. So if you would like to go to our webpage, it's thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can read our newsletter, sign up for the newsletter. It comes out every Friday, and I think it's fantastic. You can listen to our radio program going back lots of years. You can also go and find our podcast anywhere podcasts are found. email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com.